I'm Christopher Lydon with the epic novelist of Empire, Amitabh Ghosh, Indian-born at home in New York. River of Smoke is part two of his trilogy on opium, the narcotic fuel of the British Empire. Reading it, you have to wonder if he isn't writing by analogy about oil, trade, and empire in the 21st century, too, and about us. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Amitabh Ghosh, longtime listeners know that you're my authority on empire in general. The nature of the beast, rising, falling, staggering, onward in the world. Set the scene of this new novel. It's 1838. Napoleon's long gone. Britain is ruthlessly on the rise on sailing ships in Asia, from India east to Singapore, Hong Kong, and Canton. China is rich in interest, as it is today, and it looks ripe in 1838 for the plucking. Tell us what's going on here.
Well, in some peculiar ways, the early 19th century was not unlike the early 21st century, at least in one sense, which is that the West, in relation to China, had a huge trade deficit. Mm. Now, you have to remember that India was colonized really by a multinational corporation, perhaps the most powerful of all time, the East India Company. And the East India Company's main business actually was not in India. It was in China. What they did was that they took Chinese tea and sold it in England. And this was an enormous trade. I mean, it accounted for as much as 10% of English revenue. You can imagine how huge that is. That's probably as much as they get from the entire taxes on the banking sector today. So it was a huge business. And, you know, to finance it, they had to pay in silver or in gold because, you know, usually when you have a sort of situation of trade, you give one sort of goods and you take another. But the Chinese weren't really at all interested in any British goods, because they felt that anything Britain could make, they could make better, which is pretty much, I suppose, how they feel today. Mm. So in the late 18th century, it became very difficult for the East India Company because they were losing a lot of silver and, they were facing a sort of this terrible balance of payments problem in India, and it was becoming difficult for them to finance their Indian empire. So at this point, the head honchos of the East India Company in India sat down and they came up with this brilliant plan. At this point, there was a small demand for medicinal opium from India in China. And they thought, well, this is one thing that they do take. What if we grow this market? So that's what they set about doing in a very systematic way. In a period of about 30 years, they grew the market 100-fold, you know. And along with that, they started expanding their opium production facilities in India. And this became an enormous business for them. Essentially, it financed the empire. And, you know, the Chinese became aware quite early that they were facing a massive problem, an economic problem, because within a few years, the balance of trade was reversed and they were sending out lots of silver to England. Then there was also the social problem and the moral problem, which is that, you know, they were facing mass addiction. So they decided to ban opium. And they did this over a period of, 50 years or so. I mean, the emperor stated a ban after actually holding sort of hearings and, getting memorials from his mandarins and, you know, discussing the matter really very openly and very sensibly. But they decided that there was no alternative to banning opium. So they did. And their first efforts to ban it were completely defied by the British and the Americans, who continued to smuggle opium. And then in 1838, they made a concerted effort to ban it. And at that point, the British declared war on them and made in order to make them continue importing opium.
You know, we've all heard of the opium wars, but I think I slept through history class. I mean, it's a shock for Americans, even for me, after reading your books, to be reminded that Britain was hell-bent, as you say, on forcing Indian opium, an addictive drug, on China to pay for tea. I mean, it's incredible.
I know. It's a chapter of history which we really don't get taught about. I mean, not just in America, but also in India. It's an astonishing thing. I think if you went to any major university in America and got hold of 10 undergraduates and said, what was the opium war? What they would say to you is that it was the war that China made to force opium on England.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Pushing dope in the world.
That's right. But the biggest dope pushers were, in fact, England and America, because, you know, the American part in it was very large.
But you say it was the, in effect, criminal lifeblood of the British Empire. That was a huge piece of their revenues. And basically, when the opium trade finally died out in the 1920s, so did the British Empire.
Yeah, the British Empire died out shortly afterwards. And of course, one of the reasons why is that it became just too expensive. Mm. But it had probably become expensive long before that. See, by the late 19th century, early 20th century, it was a completely different situation. I mean, you know, essentially India and China had become deindustrialized and, you know, all their sort of native industries had been broken up by the British. Economically, India and China, which had been the sort of giants of world trade in the as late as the 18th century, by the late 19th century, they were really crippled. And it's taken 100 years to get back.
In both of these books, these first two of your trilogy, there's a what you can only call a theology of trade with which they push the idea of selling opium. In The Sea of Poppies, there's an unforgettable line where one of the characters says, Jesus Christ is free trade, and free trade is Jesus Christ. It's a kind of evangelism of opium and trade. In River of Smoke, that same British opium trader, Burnham, declares, it's a wonderful sentence, it is not my hand that passes sentence upon those who choose the indulgence of opium. It is the work of another, invisible, omnipotent. It is the hand of freedom, of the market, of the spirit of liberty itself, which is none other than the breath of God. Did they say things like that, really?
Absolutely. That line, Jesus Christ is free trade and free trade is Jesus Christ, is not a line that I wrote. It was actually said by a governor of Hong Kong, one of the earliest governors of Hong Kong, an Englishman. So you have to remember that, you know, the people who spearheaded the opium trade were, many of them were Scottish. Many of them had studied in Edinburgh. They were the first generation of descendants of Adam Smith, you know. Mm-hmm. So they had been studying Adam Smith. They believed very much in this idea of free trade. In their own eyes, they were acting as agents of free trade. But you look at this extraordinary thing. I mean, the kind of double think. I mean, the East India Company is producing opium as a monopoly inside India. You know, Indian merchants are essentially only allowed to participate around the peripheries of this. It's a completely fixed trade. And yet, when it comes to attacking China and forcing opium upon China, all the rhetoric is in terms of free trade. It's one of the sort of strangest aspects of this. And I think it's also sort of symptomatic, you know, of this whole sort of theology of free trade, liberalization, because every time you actually examine this credo of liberalization, you discover that there are monopolistic impulses behind it.
Mm. That notion of God behind free trade had a very scary resonance in your first book, with George W. Bush saying, in justification of the war in Iraq, that he believed that God had planted in every heart the desire to live in freedom. Therefore, we're going to invade you and, you know, blast your country to smithereens. That was easy for a lot of people to get upset about. I'm wondering, what do you do for outrage today, Amitabh Ghosh? What should we all be doing in the aftermath of the Bush years, in the aftermath of this lost first decade of the 21st century? Nobody announces those doctrines anymore, but the condition persists.
Well, I must differ with you there, Chris, because I think they announce it all the time. I mean, if you look to this day at the rhetoric of the World Bank, at the rhetoric of the IMF, the constant rhetoric that comes out of Washington and the economic institutions of New York, it's always in terms of further liberalization, further deregulation. You know, I have to say here that, you know, I think trade is a good thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's a sort of essential human impulse. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been writing about trade for 30 years. I think trade is an aspect of the imagination. My first book, as you know, was one of my earliest books was called In an Antique Land. It was about a Jewish trader who went from Egypt to India in the 12th century. And, you know, it was there that I discovered the ways in which you know, trade make for a sort of cultural interchanges, for the most essential and important cultural interchanges. So in all those ways, I think trade is a wonderful thing. But the idea that somehow trade should rule human beings, or some aspect of trade should rule human beings, to me, it's a monstrous idea.
Well, so do characters in the book who point out that England is not letting English people, men, women, children, at opium. It's highly restricted, you know, in the home population, even as it's being, you know, scattered and pushed in China. We don't think of the drug traffic coming through Mexico as free trade. We apply our labels carefully.
See, that's exactly it. I mean, it's not that, you know, the British Empire, to be fair, they didn't actually ban opium within their own territories. I mean, it was a traded substance. They were very careful to let only very little bits of opium in. But in fact, I mean, opium was very widely circulated in India. A lot of the Englishmen in India were opium addicts. I mean, this is something I discovered somewhat to my surprise. And then, you know, in fact, England was very much addicted to opium. You know, laudanum, which English people used a lot.
Wilkie Collins, for example.
Yes, Queen Victoria, she used laudanum all the time. All those nice Jane Austen ladies, they were all sort of mainlining laudanum. And what was it? It was opium, you know. So, you know, even I, as a child, I was given something called gripe water, you know. And basically, every kid in India used to be given gripe water, and in England too. And it was just a tincture of opium. So, you know, opium did circulate quite a lot. But again, as you say, you know, it's a very curious thing. One of the characters in the book, Charles King, actually from Brooklyn,
yes,
where I spend a lot of my time now, he, as you see in the book, becomes a sort of crusader against opium. And he was a really extraordinary man, I think. I mean, he stood up single-handedly to this incredible bullying that surrounded him. And, you know, he was trying to stop the opium trade. And he wrote this very powerful letter in which he said, one day, you know, this will come to visit you. Be careful of that. Think about it. And see, China was the first society to face mass addiction, you know. And they responded in many senses in a completely exemplary way. I mean, you know, they tried to regulate it. They did everything they could. And they absolutely persistently stuck with that until the 1920s. And then when opium was finally regulated, when the British Empire finally capitulated and said, okay, let's regulate this, literally within a couple of years, the Chinese had essentially beaten the problem of opium, not through state action, but by voluntary action of small groups in cities and in towns and villages.
Yeah.
And it was an extraordinary thing. You know, I was just in Brazil. And it's very interesting to see how, in fact, the drug trade, or should we say rather the regulations surrounding the drug trade today, are the single most important social problem that Mexico faces, that Brazil faces. It's militarized their society. It's eating away at the vitals of their society, you know, in so many ways. So, you know, that's the extraordinary thing. I mean, Charles King was right. This problem has come back to haunt mankind.
I want to stand back, Amitav Ghosh, and look at what you're up to in this trilogy. I have a notion of what's going on. Maybe some of it is inadvertent, but try this. It seems to me you're keeping a wide-angle anthropological diary on this moment, 2011, that we're living through, and transposing it back into Melvillian sort of fiction. Sea of Poppies, book one, as you said to me, was written in a fury about George W. Bush and the war in Iraq, itself a brutal holy war for oil, not so different from Britain's free trade wars with China over opium. In this age of Obama, the rhetoric is cooler, but the wars go on. So your new book, in the spirit of the age of Obama, is full of mixed bloods and cultural crossings. The main character is an Indian Parsi named Bahram, not Barak. But like Barak, he's deep in this dirty business, even though his heart is not in it. Bahram is the first brown man in the all-white Chamber of Commerce in Canton, but it doesn't finally accept him. He's a decent man who introspects on the morality of pushing dope. and he seems about to renounce it. It's made him rich, but he's going to renounce it when he puts himself into a deep opium dream and then dies. Sounds to me like Washington in 2011.
Well, that would be a sort of one way of reading the books, which is that it's a kind of parable on modern times. But that's not at all, in fact, what I had in mind. I mean, certainly, you know, contemporary events are very alive in my mind, and as they are in all of ours. But no, I mean, you know, when you really immerse yourself deeply in a historical moment, you know, you begin to inhabit that moment and you try to be true to it. So, yes, there are parallelisms, but I wouldn't say that either Sea of Poppies or River of Smoke is a parable of, you know, what's happening in contemporary times. Not at all. I would say that there are parallelisms, but, you know, I wouldn't say that it's a direct transposition by any means. And certainly, you know, one of the reasons why I am not a historian and why I am a novelist is because in the end, it's always the characters who carry a book. Mm. And in this case, Behram was to me an incredibly compelling and interesting character. I mean, and he's an interesting character because he faces this ethical dilemma. And I do think that Parsis, because they come from this Zoroastrian background, which has a very, very strong idea of good and evil, which in many ways invented the ideas of good and evil, which then percolated into other religions. Mm. He faces this dilemma very, very powerfully. And, you know, his ethical dilemma becomes, if you like, the crux of the book.
I'd love you to speak about China in general, then and now. It's a huge piece of your story in 1838. It's an even bigger element of our global story today. In River of Smoke, there's one class of Englishmen that's, as we say, pushing opium on China. But there's another great character, Fitcher Penrose, who is working his own personal business, getting plants out of China for commercial development in England and the world. And we learn that azaleas, wisteria, hydrangeas, chrysanthemums, many more common plants all originated in China, not to mention rhubarb. And there's this fantasy cure-all golden camellia that people are hunting down. All of it to suggest, I think, the fabulous breadth and depth of China's historical and cultural treasure. The big question in the novel, and in our lives as Americans today, I think, is how to see China not as a faceless mass of people, or as a factory, but as a civilization.
You must remember that, you know, I'm from India, and yes, if there's any country that regards China with greater apprehension than the U.S., it's certainly India. I mean, in India today, there's almost a kind of neurosis about China, a sort of hysteria, I would say, a sense of rivalry, a sense of fear, a sense of having lost, suffered in a war with China, and so on. And, you know, the degree to which we in India are ignorant of China is actually quite staggering. I mean, we share a 1,000-mile border with China. And yet, if you go to even well-educated Indians, they won't be able to tell you, you know, things like where is Chengdu, where is Sichuan, where is Hunan. I mean, China is to most Indians an absolutely blank slate. India has its back turned towards China. And now it's sort of gotten worse, I think, because of all this sort of constant din that you hear in the international media about a China-India rivalry. So for me, you know, I hadn't been to China until I started writing Sea of Poppies. I knew nothing about China. I've traveled a lot in other parts of the world, but I hadn't been much in China. And for me, I think one of the great gifts of this, of these books, of this trilogy, has been the discovery of China. I mean, you know, it's been such a wonderful thing. I mean, I've been traveling there a lot now. I go there two or three times a year to different parts of China. And I must say, I'm completely, in many ways, completely enchanted by it. I mean, of course, there are a great many problems in China. There are many things which are completely distasteful in China, as there are in India and in most other places in the world. But, you know, the experience of meeting ordinary Chinese people, the sort of warmth you encounter on the streets, the friendliness, and just the astonishing beauty of the place and the... I mean, all of that has been really a kind of incredible adventure for me.
Something fascinating has happened since 1838 and today. I mean, we do so much business with China, and yet all that pidgin language, all the stories, all the food, all the thickly settled Pearl River just teeming with life seems to have disappeared from our context today. What happened?
Well, you know, this was one of the things which really fascinated me in writing about that pre-1840s world in China. One of the main sort of protagonists of this book, I think, is actually a city, Canton, the modern Guangzhou. And it was an extraordinary place. I mean, you know, it's this vast city, this megalopolis, and it has been such, you know, for millennia. The population of Guangzhou was much greater than, say, London or Paris in the 18th and 19th centuries. And it was an incredibly sort of busy place, which is why it was exporting so many things to the rest of the world. But what is very, very interesting about Guangzhou, especially to me, is that what we know as Canton was actually a very small enclave within Guangzhou. It was just a sort of little quarter-mile area where the foreign merchants were allowed to live. And they lived, no foreign women were allowed, so they lived there as bachelors. In this little enclave called the 13 Factories. And, you know, these were some of the richest men in the world. They were the ancestors of some of the richest families in the world to this day. Some of the men who lived there, you know, were great American patriarchs, including Franklin Delano Roosevelt's grandfather. He was a huge opium merchant. There was the Coolidges made their money there. Washington Irving, the great writer, you know, he had family living in Canton, trading in opium. He himself was investing in opium, you know. It's so extraordinary. I mean, the links and connections between Brooklyn and Canton are absolutely fascinating, really. So there were these, all these connections. And this one place, this one tiny place, was exporting enormous amounts of the world's industrial goods. Porcelain, for example. Then they were sending out tea, they were sending out silks, they were sending out, and they were sending out these images. I mean, to me, this was a completely fascinating aspect of Canton. You know, so many of the pictures that you see, 19th century pictures that were hanging in American homes, pictures of George Washington actually came from Canton, you know. Mm-hmm. So many of the portraits that you'll see in American homes, 19th century portraits, were actually made in Canton. Similarly, there was this incredible sort of botanical exchange. So many of the world's flowers. So it was, you know, it was really a place that was incredibly sort of bounteous. It gave the world so much.
It's fascinating that you say India has this block about China as much as we do, if not more, and it's much, much closer. What's the Amitav Ghosh prescription to get our heads around this treasure?
Well, believe me, I'm as baffled by it as you are, because, in fact, India also has a lot in common with China. You know, there's the tradition of Buddhism that went from one country to another, and so many other sorts of smaller traditions and just sort of smaller things. But yes, it is absolutely the case that in India, there's a complete block about China. There's a complete sense of an absence, almost, you might say. I would say that Americans have a much more informed relationship with China, partly because of that whole missionary tradition in the early 20th century, and because, you know, so, you know, in many ways, I think China's presence in America is much greater than it is in India, which is just across the border. I'll just give you one example. You know, it's, I mean, any Indian traveling in the world becomes accustomed to seeing Indian restaurants. I mean, they're sort of ubiquitous. You can't get away from them. But in China, you never see them. Hmm. It's very strange.
Speak, if you will, about what I call the sex of empire in this book. I think you're picking up a theme from our friend Ashish Nandi, that empire, the practice of it, turns on a sort of hyper-masculinization of power at the expense of the feminine side in all of us, but of the imperialists and their victims. In the book, our opium trader Burnham says, masculinity has everything to do with it. Effeminacy is the curse of the Asiatic. It's what makes him susceptible to opium. Until the masculine energies of this country, meaning China, are replenished and renewed, its people will never understand the value of freedom, nor will they appreciate the cardinal importance of free trade. I'm wondering, how is it that so many of the English opium traders in Canton in your book are gay?
Well, you know, this is one of the fascinating things about post-Enlightenment Europe, I mean, 18th and 19th century Europe, because that's the moment in which they begin to invent, you know, this very specific idea of gender, where, you know, the whole idea of what it means to be a man, to be masculine and so on, undergoes this enormous change. And that's also when you get these communities of intensely bonded men. I think it's the most distinctive aspect of the 19th century, that you have this incredible gender segregation within European communities. Never before, really, in the history of mankind has it ever happened that, you know, men and women are kept so rigorously apart as they were in European societies, really. You take the idea of a ship. I mean, you know, for 5-6 years, these people were sailing. They were just stuck on this ship.
Yes.
And that was the normal. Whereas on Chinese ships, for example, they always carried women. I mean, the women worked on the crew. It's not that women are incapable of working on a crew. I mean, they're perfectly capable. And even on European ships, I think there were a fair number of transvestite women disguised as men, sometimes working as sailors. But the principle of it was that armies had to be all male, that, you know, sailors had to be all male. I mean, it's, you know, of course, men did the fighting in the Middle East and elsewhere as well, but they always had huge companies of camp followers, you know, who were, as it were, an integral part of of an Asian army. So it's a curious thing that you see coming into being in the 19th century, this very strict gender segregation, this invention of this role of masculinity and this role of women. And there again, you have this extraordinary society in Canton where, you know, women are not allowed. And these English men and American men and women, American men live really as bachelors. Of course, some of them had wives who either back home or in Macau. But, you know, if you read their letters, if you read about them, it's perfectly clear that many of them were, in fact, very, very attached, you know, to that way of life, to their particular sort of bachelordom. I don't think you can call them gay or whatever, because, you know, that role didn't exist at that time. But they were very much a part of that all-male world. They were completely sort of immersed in it. William Jardine, who is a historical figure, as you know, and who founded multinational corporations that still exist, he lived really a bachelor existence in Canton until his mid-50s. When he finally left, he was absolutely heartbroken. I mean, you know, he made this speech where he was weeping because he's leaving his friends, and they all were heartbroken to leave this, you know, this community that they were in.
Come back to the moment we're in. We spoke about Tsia Papi's between the election and the inauguration of Barack Obama, and you thought that the direction of American power had shifted. I think I thought so too. What's happened since then?
Well, I think one of the things which has become quite evident is that, in fact, the office of the presidency is not as potent as we think. I mean, it's almost a symbolic role. I mean, you know, this country has a huge sort of, this country, like all countries, has a huge machinery that sort of grinds on. And the person at the top is really limited in his ability to change directions and in his ability to change course. And, you know, I think that's what we're really seeing, that change, as Obama promised, is actually not possible.
We're aware, as you've written elsewhere, of a deep state, even in this open democratic country. I mean, the deep state may be Pakistan's gift to political language, but we're waking up to the fact that it's real.
Yes, that's exactly the case. I mean, it was really, I really believe that often it's, you know, places that are, as it were, in extremis that reveal the realities of the world around us. And I think Pakistan, in giving us this idea of the deep state, has really shown us something very real about the world at large. I mean, you know, what's actually happened is that the notion of the public good, as we used to know it, has disappeared, you know. And a lot of it has to do with, if you like, this kind of free market thinking, where the idea is that, you know, all goods result from collective greed, as it were. And we see that that's chimerical. It's not, it doesn't happen that way. And, but in the process, the idea of the public good has, in fact, evaporated. And I think that's what the whole world is struggling with right now. Where do you define a commons? Where do you define, you know, what is the public good, and who speaks for the public good? In many ways, you know, England has been a beacon of a certain kind of democracy, and it's been that for about 700-800 years, and its you know, its system has proved remarkably flexible over this long durée. It's lasted for a very long time. And now it's so interesting to see how even the British, who have historically had a very strong idea of the public good, they have historically had stigmatized corruption at all levels. And now suddenly you see in this country that there's such a wide swathe of corruption. You see that, and that is what it is. You know, corruption is the other face of the disappearance of the public good. And everywhere you go now, this is the one thing that you hear. You hear it in Brazil. You hear it in India. You hear it in China. And people are just, I think people are really now at a loss across the world.
What's a citizen to do, Amitav Ghosh? And what's a president to do who, at some level, we believe still gets it?
You know, I must say two things here.
Please.
But one is that as a, you know, just a thinking human being out in the world, it's very depressing because you do see the whole idea of citizenship being increasingly sort of devalued and disempowered, if you like. The second thing is, I do think that, you know, one of the sort of regrettable things that's happened over the last 20 years is that politics has been presented to us as the be-all and end-all of our lives, you know? I mean, it's like politics is suggested to us as the equivalent of a moral life. It's become this huge cannibalizing entity, at once religion and art, and everything is now said to be politics. Well, that's not how I think of politics. I think of politics as a set of arrangements that we make to live in the world. One's intellectual life, one's moral life, one's artistic life, in the end, is private, it's individual. And I think, you know, to keep one's sense of sanity, one must insist on that, you know, the political is not the sphere of the beautiful. It's not the sphere of the perfectible. It will always be corrupt and degenerate, if you like. It's always been that everywhere. But people, even in the most difficult circumstances of the Middle Ages or, you know, wherever, always did manage to create and find their spheres of beauty and their spheres of a moral life and an artistic life and an aesthetic life and a spiritual life.
That's fascinating. We have to force ourselves in a depressing political moment to remember our spirit life, our poetry life, our music life, our family
life. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, this is part of the wide-angle anthropological mind that I celebrate in you, Amitav Ghosh, and it's why your work is endlessly interesting. There's no one thread and there's no one point, and you're watching so many, you know, rings at the circus. We thank you for it, and we love reading through it.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure to talk to you, Chris.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.